Just a moment. Just a moment.
Welcome to the Future Law Podcast, exploring where the law has been.
Hey Siri, take a selfie.
And where it's going.
Oh, good afternoon.
From the brilliant.
My name is Sophia, and I am the latest and greatest robot.
To the scary.
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave?
And everything in between. Please welcome your very real and very human host, Mike Madison.
Okay, welcome to the Future Law Podcast, where we cut through the noise and the hype and get to the straight story about the future of law, legal education, legal technology, and the legal profession. I am your host today, Michael Madison, professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I'm delighted to welcome today our guest, Kevin Miller. Kevin is the CEO of a Pittsburgh-based legal tech firm called Legal Sifter. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me.
So let's get right into it. Tell us about Legal Sifter. What does the company do?
Well, Legal Sifter helps companies work with the most important document in global commerce, the contract. Those things are ubiquitous, and they are ubiquitously painful. We've built a product that reads contracts and gives advice. Everybody will tell you how hard it is to navigate these documents, both just reading them and reviewing them and negotiating them. Our users can upload the contract that they're negotiating. Our tool, which uses artificial intelligence, will review it and give them in-context help, tell them what's there, what's not there, and tell them what to do about it. And we're pretty excited about it.
So describe a little bit of the Legal Sifter story. What was the genesis for this product? What, where did the idea come from? How did it get developed? How long have you been at it? Some of the gritty details.
The company got started out of Carnegie Mellon University, and the original co-founders built a beta product that read contracts and gave advice for freelance software developers who never take their contracts to attorneys because they simply can't afford them. And the idea was upload your contract and the tool would score it for you and give you some advice. And they launched it to the web as far back as 2014, the summer of 2014. They got one article publicly on the web and they got 5,000 users in a week. And that's amazing. And it speaks to the need for fast, affordable legal services, particularly around the challenges of reading contracts. And anyway, they put the product on the shelf. They weren't ready to commercialize it. They weren't quite sure what to do with it. They didn't have the funding. I actually showed up a year later in 2015, and I came in as an investor and as the CEO, and I heard that story, and I said, wow, that's a product. Not only is that a product, that's a product that can help a lot of people at the highest levels of the business-to-business market, all the way down to the business-to-consumer market. And we just had this vision that said, gosh, we're going to bring affordable legal services to the world by empowering people with AI, and we think that doing that with the legal community is a good idea, and doing that in contracts to start is a good idea. And so we started with that simple beta test and said, let's build this product for real. And it took us almost 2 years to get it out the door, and it came out in the summer of 17, and we've just been going gangbusters since.
So you're a licensed lawyer yourself. But at some point you made the transition from lawyer to investor and entrepreneur. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I got really lucky. You know, 20 years ago I went to law school and I passed the bar in the state of Ohio here in the United States, and then immediately sprinted from the law as fast as I could. And I went in and got an MBA, and I happened to be popping out at a time when the internet was going nuts. And I interviewed and got a job with one of the most successful IPOs in the history of the NASDAQ, a company here in Pittsburgh called Free Markets. And that company went from $30 to $150 million in 18 months, and we went from 300 to 1,000 people in 12 months, and it was just insane. And I got the taste of what that's like to build an incredibly great disruptive organization that changed things for the better on top of really amazing technology, which is what that company did. And I've spent now almost 20 years working for, this is my fourth company, all of which had one thing in common. They attacked a function that was desperate for new technology to help push it forward. I've spent time in education, safety, and procurement, and now here I am back. Back using my legal degree. My parents are very happy. Working in the legal profession, trying to do the same thing. And so I'm really pleased. I love the law, and I'm so happy to be back in it after all these years, and it's just worked out for me.
So from an entrepreneur's standpoint, what's distinctive right now about legal tech?
Well, I think artificial intelligence changes the game. I think that, you know, I spent a lot of time with lawyers, and they are rightfully skeptical of how technology can change their lives for the better or for the worse or in the middle. And that's because primarily the technology that has serviced the lawyer over the last 10, 20, 30 years serves the lawyer, not the client. And that contrasts dramatically from every other function in the global enterprise. So accounting or sales or manufacturing or service or marketing, they've had tools, both software and hardware, to help them do things cheaper, faster, better that serve their internal or external clients. The lawyers haven't had that. They have tools that help them with time management or help them with billing. Even the great revolution in digitizing the law library really helps the lawyer, not the client. AI changes that. There's good reasons why it hasn't happened to date. Lawyers are thinking, reading, writing animals, and they need thinking, reading, writing technology to help them do things differently. And AI can do a little thinking, do a little reading, do a little writing. And so now lawyers have the opportunity to do more with technology than they ever thought was possible because it can now replicate a little bit of what they do as opposed to past technologies. And that's a major change.
I'll bet that a fair number of current practicing lawyers are more than a little skeptical of the value added potentially by AI. So when you're marketing legal software services and products, how do you overcome that skepticism, or where do you find the enthusiasm?
Yeah, so we spend a lot of time working with, and a lot of our clients are attorneys, both inside counsel and law firms, but we also spend a lot of time with professionals on the procurement side and sales and operations and finance, all of whom have to navigate contracts, and they wish they could have their attorney present in all of those contractual negotiations, and they can't because of cost and speed. Our tool solves that problem for them, so they come to us looking for that relief. But when we talk to lawyers, particularly those at law firms, what we try to help them understand and see, and I know, understand this as a former COO of a 1,000-person organization who's managed every function and bought a lot of stuff, we try to help them understand that, look, you know, your clients are only sending you 5 out of 100 contracts that they are negotiating. And it's because it doesn't make sense for them to send you a $5,000 supply chain contract, have it sit with you for 2 or 3 days, and get an 800 or 1,000 pound bill back in a couple of days. That's not an insurance policy clients are willing to pay for. But if you ask them, would they like their lawyer to review their contract, 100% of them would say yes. And 70% of them would say, I'd like to do it in an online way, because that's how they buy other things from other vendors. It's weird the way they buy legal services, that it's always a person as opposed to everything else they buy in their supply chain. So what we try to help the law firms understand, and even internal counsel, is listen, this software, this technology can give your clients a proxy for you. And in the absence of you, which is how they operate most of the time, this is better than nothing. And in fact, it's way better than nothing. And it will make them cheaper, faster, better, and safer. And you, as a law firm, can actually improve your revenues, improve your margins, and get deeper and enrich your relationship with that client by understanding them greater. So there's lots of benefit here. The other thing we say, Michael, is this is going to make you a better lawyer. You know, I when I drive around Pittsburgh, as you know, Pittsburgh's a hilly city. It is hard to get around. I never know if I'm east, west, north, or south, and there's three rivers, which is even more confusing. I have to have Google Maps on most of the places I go to, except when I go to my kid's school or to the office or to the grocery store. I know where that stuff is. But everywhere else, I need help, and I am happy to have Google Maps. That's the way it is with contracts. And, you know, frankly, I don't want to get on a plane where, a pilot isn't using a pre-flight checklist. I don't want to go under the knife in surgery where a surgeon with 30 years of experience is using a pre-flight checklist. I don't want to buy legal services from a lawyer that doesn't have AI looking over their shoulder, because a lawyer plus an algorithm is stronger than either by itself. And ultimately what we say to these lawyers is, this is not a threat to you. This is going to make you a better lawyer. It's going to introduce a new reasonable standard of care, improve your quality, and that's good for everybody.
So, wow, so many things I hear in that that I want to follow up on. But let me focus on the fact that AI as such kind of disappeared. So in that narrative, right, AI is sort of a critical part of the technology. It's a critical part of the value proposition, but it's not your pitch.
That's right.
Right. It's AI is pitched as a tool, as a critical tool, as a necessary tool, but as an aid rather than as a lead proposition. Right.
That's right. I think when I talk to folks for the first time, particularly attorneys, you know, particularly attorneys of a certain age, and I'll date myself a little bit. Some people remember the Max Headroom thing from the 80s or 90s or whenever that was, and they imagine AI as this entity that's going to replace them, an artificial lawyer. And we take care. It's actually pretty easy to see once you see our product or any of the other products that are out there in the marketplace. It's pretty easy if you just give it a minute to understand that, wow, this is kind of acting like a really incredible grammar check or a spell check, except it's checking for terms and conditions in a contract. And it's going to help me. It's going to help my clients, but it's not going to replace me. In fact, it's going to allow me to extend my knowledge to my clients, you know, in a way that they need it. And the great analogy that I like to use is actually with higher education. You know, look at what's happened in the last 15 years in higher education, the breakthroughs that we've made by using online technologies to bring, you know, otherwise unattainable knowledge to a whole host of students that just can't afford to come down to the University of Pittsburgh at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Now they can access that online. We didn't replace the practitioners there. We extended them. And that's what we did with software. And that's what's going to happen here. It just happens that, you know, it happens to be enabled by AI because of the unique nature and the difficult work that lawyers do. So lawyers need to see this as a tool that supplements them and supplements their practice. And I think all they really need to do is experience this stuff, and I think they'll get there.
It's not
Max Headroom was the point.
There is, though, a tier of, we'll say for Legal Sifter and for contract review as the situation here, there's a tier of small businesses who, for just basic budget reasons, historically have gone without.
Yes.
Right. They call the lawyer in case it's really mission critical, super high risk, can't avoid it, but otherwise do the best they can with self-help. And it sounds like some aspect of what you're describing, sort of contract review in a much sort of more efficient, cost-effective, sort of ordinary business operations kind of way, is accessible to, say, that tier of users without the lawyers involved at all.
Yeah, at a super high level, you know, the market for legal services globally is an $850 billion market, and it should be 2x or 3x that if you meet the actual demand that's in the marketplace from businesses and consumers for legal services. You know, we all know this. We know this from the Justice Gap reports. We know this from talking to any small business owner, talking to any large business owner about all the legal work that their professionals do that they just otherwise can't send to their in-house counsel or outside counsel because of the lack of scale. And so what we imagine for the small business, and I'll come back to our business specifically, Legal Sifter, most contracts in the small and mid-sized business markets are reviewed by professionals, not lawyers. It's never seen by a lawyer. We imagine not only delivering our products to those folks directly, but we really are excited about delivering those products through law firms who focus on that market and allow them to go after that market and extend their services in a way that allows the lawyers to make money while they sleep and serve their clients while they sleep, and allows those small businesses to access that lawyer's knowledge without incurring just bills that don't make sense or turnaround times that don't make sense for the speed of business and the cost of business. So, you know, we're really excited about the potential of this technology to extend lawyers down market and actually meet a demand that they otherwise can't see today.
Expand the pie.
That's right, and dramatically. And there are many, many examples in many, many industries where that's happened. That's what's going to happen here. Is ultimately, this is going to be a renaissance for the legal services market over the next 10 to 20 years. You know, so many markets have expanded with the internet and software over the last 20, 30 years. But we haven't seen that level of growth in the legal service market because it's full service all the time. this type of technology is going to allow lawyers to be creative about how they deliver their services, both in a self-service, partial service, on top of their full-service way. It's going to expand the market. You're going to get cheaper, faster, better on the low end. You're not going to lose anything on the high end for the most part, because that's strategic stuff. People are willing to pay and willing to wait for that stuff, and that's where most of the market is today. But you're going to get down market into the everyday transactions, and you're going to make a lot of clients happy.
So let's pivot a little bit and talk a little bit about what this means, not for clients and current practitioners. Let's talk about people coming into the profession now. So people who are training to become lawyers, people who are still in school today, getting licensed in the near future, or people who have recently graduated and starting to build careers. And I know from my experience in our law school, which I think is it's a typical environment, this kind of technology-enabled change is largely hidden from most law schools going through most ordinary law programs, whether it's the JD program here or equivalent programs in other countries. They still show up in the first year of law school, and we feed them contracts and property and torts and the basic law school subjects. And they expect to graduate and get sort of traditional law practice jobs in small offices and small firms or big firms. And whether that's business or other kinds of practice areas, it's still imagined by law teachers as a very sort of craft-based profession, very hands-on, very face-to-face, you know, the expert counsel coming from the mouth of the practitioner to the ears of the client. So the question for you is, how does the revolution that you're participating in right now, how should that be incorporated into the training pipeline? What should students and law teachers today know about this?
Yeah, I think there's two pieces of advice I'd give the entire community, and it's based on personal experience. The first is raise the level of awareness about what's happening by 1,000%. So I'll tell a personal story to make the point. So I graduated from law school in 1998, and I went right into business school in 1999 and 2000. That was the height of the internet bubble. And I spent 3 years from 95 to 98 looking through the law books, right? Spending that time in the legal library or in the law library. I didn't know what was going on at all. I mean, I was barely paying attention. It was all I could do to get through the bar exam. And then I took the bar exam, and then a week later I was in business school, and there were my new business school students sitting in the back of the room day trading on something called E-Trade, on shares for something called Amazon.com and Google and BarnesandNoble.com and Toys.com and all these things. And all they were talking about was what was going on in Silicon Valley and what was going on with startups and how they all wanted to work in an internet startup. And I was completely out of my depth. And it was really because I didn't have I had a complete lack of awareness of what was going on. And there was nothing in the law curriculum that prepared me for that. Despite the fact that a lot of my law firm or my law student, fellow law students went on to service those same internet explosive companies in their careers, they didn't have the context for an awareness. So I would first recommend that the entire community dedicate more time to just having a greater level of awareness about the types of services and solutions and products and technologies that are available now that just weren't available 5 years ago. A good source of that is The Artificial Lawyer, which is a nice blog written by Richard Tromans out in the United Kingdom, and he does a pretty good job. That's my first piece of advice. My second piece of broad advice is, it's not about the AI. The AI, none of us, I mean, I barely understand this stuff. None of us in the legal profession really have the skills to become coders and become data scientists, and that's okay. But what you do have to understand is, you know, how that technology can play into solving real problems for your firm, for your teams, and for your clients. So my advice is, as an educator or as a student, think like designers and product managers. Train your students like product managers. Help them understand that the technology is nice, but it doesn't really matter. You know, you start with a problem, and then you go to solve that problem with people, process, and tools. You now have some major tools to solve heretofore unsolvable problems because of AI. And all you really need to understand is how to drive the change within an organization or a client or a firm to get those tools to solve that problem. So training your law students or thinking as a law student like a product manager would be a good idea. And I always recommend The Design of Everyday Things by Don Norman, which is a great book that's very accessible. You don't have to be an engineer, and it'll help you get into that mindset. And I think that's just a big part of it. And that is nowhere in much of the law school curriculum today.
Fair enough. So from beginning lawyers, young lawyers, new lawyers, to people who already have established careers, right? So a business lawyer, a corporate lawyer, commercial lawyer who's got an established practice, has an established rhythm of doing things in their own office or their own department or their own group in a law firm, and they're looking around and they're seeing all this hype around AI, and maybe they've encountered a little bit of information about companies like Legal Sifter, and they want to make sure that they don't lose out, they don't lose a competitive edge. So what are the first couple or three things that they should do to sort of figure out whether this is right for them and their clients?
Yeah, so first I'll repeat myself and I'll say, you know, create that level of awareness that they otherwise don't have. Get subscribed to The Artificial Lawyer, listen to this podcast, do a couple other things to make yourself aware. But there's plenty of materials out there. Just open up the internet and find out and get yourself aware. Second is, you've got to have a point of view about where you guys are going, where you're going for the next 3 to 5 years. What's a victory for you? And when you think about growing over the next 3 to 5 years, either as an individual lawyer or as a group or as a firm, you know, you've got to talk about, well, what are the gaps in our skill sets as a firm, for example, that I've got to fill, and I have this point of view, particularly if I've got 25 years of experience, I've got this point of view about how technology can't fill that gap because of my experience with legal tech over the last 25 years. You got to kind of throw that out the window now because AI is going to change that. AI is going to offer new solutions that otherwise couldn't be there. And so you've got to take the knowledge from my first bullet and go and call on some of these suppliers in and around some of the gaps that you guys have in a practice area and see if they can help you. So you just pick up the phone and call some people, because guys like me, gals like me, they're going to help you see if there's a fit or not pretty quickly. And there's plenty of buyer's guides that are out there now that'll help you navigate what suppliers can do, whatever. So second is, pick a problem that you thought was not solvable with tech and open your mind up again and go out and search the suppliers. And then the third is, and this is probably the most important thing I can say, is just, you're going to have to carve out time. And this is particularly true for the law firms. You know, law firms are, as we all know, very different than, you know, businesses, the way they run. But they are businesses. They are 100% businesses. But so many of them are not dedicating the money, time, energy to working on the business, working on the process, working on the tools. They work on the people. But they largely are devoid of that natural investment, and it's part of the business model, in tools and in process. And the best law firms are not that way. But I think every business affords time and money and energy to that.
So some law firms, both in the U.S. and outside the U.S., have invested internal resources in building their own technology platforms and their own technology tools. And some of them have achieved a lot of success, made a lot of money, distinguished themselves in the marketplace, and been very proud of what they've accomplished. So I don't know if you have some thoughts on what we might call sort of the make or buy distinction, right? Should a law practice sort of build this internal capability on their own? Should they invest in vendors and outside suppliers? How to balance those two approaches?
Law firms should invest in product management, frankly, and that capacity inside of their organization. And, you know, great product managers, it's a profession. People use product managers, and all of their clients use product managers, so they understand the value of that profession. Law firms should bring product managers into their organization. And what that will do for a law firm is that will allow that firm to take on new technologies in a smart way, build or buy, and they should be buying most of the time, and I'll tell you why. And they will be able to, if they're good at their job, navigate the internal operations of that firm, as well as the outside market demands of their clients, and plug in the right technologies into that firm to create new offerings or enhanced offerings to differentiate that firm, to further their business with their clients and make their clients happier, et cetera. So I would say the number one thing that law firms can invest in is a product management-like orientation and a product manager function, frankly. And that's not something you're going to see in many firms, but they do exist, or proxies of the such. And I think good firms would be smart to do that. I would be skeptical of law firms taking on a lot of technology work, frankly. I think they're going to have trouble recruiting the best talent, to be honest. It doesn't mean you can't get good talent, but managing software engineers and managing data scientists is very, very different than managing attorneys. And if it's not for the faint of heart, if you haven't done it before, not because they're particularly difficult, it's just different. And they're going to have expectations that are very different from your lawyers. And so if you're going to think about insourcing, you need to think about, can I create a culture, a support mechanism, an environment in which they're going to thrive? I very often say to mid-market companies, why do you have one general counsel? You know, that general counsel, you usually have 600 people in your organization and the general counsel. It is very hard for a manufacturer to service the needs of that general counsel. You'd be better off with that general counsel in a law firm. I say the same thing to a law firm who's thinking about insourcing a bunch of software engineers. If you're going to do that, you better think about dedicating a separate subsidiary that is related to that law firm and is run by business people who understand how to bring products to market.
Interesting. So let's talk about challenges and barriers, right? So what are the big obstacles, both obstacles to uptake and adoption of sort of AI-enabled tools in law, and if you've had specific experience with sort of pushback and barriers to Legal Sifter advancing its business? So what are the key points that you've had to sort of confront and overcome, and what do you see going forward in that area?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is education. I think there's no standard yet on how across any law firm or any inside counsel team, how they adopt legal tech. And I think that's because it's a really frothy time. You know, again, I'll use the mid-90s as an example. You know, there was a lot of shakeout between 1993, 1995, 1997, 1999, so forth and so on. And we're at the beginnings of that. For those of us who work through that time period and study during that time period, it feels like it's happening all over again, just in legal tech. And so I expect a good level of frothiness over the next 3 to 5 years while new markets are created, new companies come and go. And that's hard for buyers or would-be partners to sort through. So the first challenge we face is, how do vendors like us educate the market about what we do, what problems we solve, why we're different, those types of things, why somebody should spend time with us? And it's very hard for the buyer to kind of navigate what's what. And so that's kind of the first barrier. I think the second barrier is a bit of a red herring. You hear a lot about lawyers don't like technology. Lawyers fear AI. Okay, sure, but that's true in every function where you have new technology that is a little bit disruptive. I think that barrier is always 100% overcome by somebody just doing something, just making a decision without overthinking it to do a pilot in a couple of areas and just get started. You know, this is where, you know, 100% plan can be the enemy. What is that phrase? Great can be the enemy of good, or something. Whatever that.
We don't want to let the perfect plan be the enemy of a good plan.
We don't want to let the perfect plan be the enemy of a good plan here. You know, none of the suppliers have this perfectly figured out yet. And if you're the kind of organization that wants a perfect product, then wait. The danger is that your competitors are going to not wait, and they are going to make progress, and they're going to be way up the learning curve, and you're going to fall behind. It may not happen this year, it may not happen next year, but it will happen. So my advice is, you know, just do something. And doing something, no matter how small, gets you in the flow. It gets you in the flow of the conversation. It gets you in the flow of what's happening and what's changing. But what it will also do is it will work through a lot of the internal challenges that you're going to face as an inside counsel or as a law firm, politically, socially, process-wise, culturally. You want to get over the hump on that. And because what you're going to find is this isn't as much of a threat as you think it is. It's the opposite. It's an opportunity to move into this wonderful renaissance, open up all this demand, do things a little bit cheaper, faster, better. And we've seen in history that when that happens, you know, the organizations that take on that early tend to do better in the long run. And so my second piece of advice would just be to do something. Just pick one of these little vendors, us, somebody else, and do something and get in the flow.
It's a little ironic to hear an entrepreneur talking about how they're not disruptive.
I always think about it as continuous improvement. And, you know, as an organization, you're always improving if you're good. You know, I've been in good organizations every time. I've been very lucky in my career, and we just kept getting better. And I just can't imagine working for an organization that didn't have that mindset. And so from my perspective, it's like AI is just another thing, like process and people, that can help us get better. And that the real challenge is, can we manage the change? And not, you know, how disruptive are we going to be? How not disruptive are we? I just don't think about it that way. And I don't think our team thinks about it that way. We're just like, okay, how do we solve problems for organizations? Because here's what our clients will tell you is, they think it's cool that we have artificial intelligence, but you know what they really are buying? They're buying solutions to pain. That's what they're buying. And if we happen to do it with people, process, tools, AI, some mix of that, they don't freaking care. What they care about is, are you going to make me better? Are you going to solve my problem in an affordable way, at speed, at cost? That's what I want. And if AI gets you there, that's great. But I don't necessarily need AI to do it if I just want to solve the problem.
So last question, let's wrap up with this. I'll turn one of your comments earlier back around with you, which is if you look ahead 3 to 5 years for Legal Sifter as a company, what's victory for you?
Oh, we think that we are doing a couple of things that are pretty influential. Number one, tactically, we don't think people are going to review complex documents in the future without the help of artificial intelligence. You know, they grammar check them today, they spell check them today. In the not too distant future, with our tool and others, you're going to be able to review complex documents and get in-context advice. And it's going to be meaningful, it's going to be fast, and it's going to help you do your jobs better. And we expect to be the winner there. We expect for people to sift their contracts before they sign them. And so that's, you know, selfishly on our part, what we expect to happen. The second thing I think that where we think we can have a positive influence on the broader market is we think we will be able to, and we're doing this today, we have multiple law firms, a couple dozen around the world that are doing exactly what I'm about to say online and with their clients around the world. We are going to show law firms how to become software and service organizations. You know, we think that people want more of their lawyers. You know, we complain about them mostly because we can't get more of them. And AI specifically in software is going to allow lawyers to extend themselves, serve their clients while they sleep. We're going to bring that business model to a lot of law firms. And we think that's a good thing. And we think that the law firms that we're working with today, 3 to 5 years from now, they'll have significant revenues, significant clients, where they are just serving them with software, or serving them with software and service, or software and partial service and full service. And we will have helped them get there. And that's exciting for us, because we know we can't do what they can do. I don't want to be a law firm. It is not our desire. We want to make, you know, affordable legal services happen. And the only way we're going to do that is by working with the legal profession. And so I'd expect 3 to 5 years from now, it's going to be a story that we helped a bunch of law firms start to make money with software. And then that's going to get replicated by a lot of suppliers and a lot of law firms in the next wave of this.
Great. Okay, that's a great place to end. Thank you, Kevin. That's fantastic. I am Mike Madison. You've been listening to the Future Law Podcast. You can find us online at thefuturelawpodcast.com. You can download us at Apple and Google and all of your favorite podcast providers. And we look forward to your listening to us, this podcast, and future episodes. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Future Law Podcast. Hey! For links to the articles mentioned and to contact the hosts, visit futurelawpodcast.com.